Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, January 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump gets to work.
We think we can cut regulations by 75%, maybe more.
But Trump's also facing his first legal challenge as president.
You know, we've been warning him about this for 2 months, and it's a problem. It's a serious problem.
Dozens have been killed in severe weather in the United States. Also ahead, 3D printers now being used for cooking. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, it's been a busy 4 days for President Donald Trump. He signed documents officially withdrawing the United States from the 12-nation Pacific Rim Free Trade Deal. Trans-Pacific Partnership had been negotiated since 2009, but U.S. Congress never ratified it. The TPP covers trade between Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Malaysia, Chile, Canada, Mexico, and four other countries. Trump also signed an order freezing pay and hiring for all federal employees except the military, and met with a group of U.S. business leaders pledging to slash taxes and regulations.
That we're going to be cutting regulation massively. Now, we're going to have regulation, and it'll be just as strong and just as good and just as protective of the people as the regulation we have right now. The problem with the regulation that we have right now is that you can't do anything. I have people that tell me they have more people working on regulations than they have doing product. And it's out of control. It's gotten out of control.
Also Monday, Trump's White House spokesman vowed that the new administration intends to, quote, never to lie to the news media. Press Secretary Sean Spicer's comments came in the wake of a growing clash between the new president and the journalists assigned to cover him at his White House during the first few days of his administration.
We have a right to go out there and correct the record. And I think that over and over again, there is this attempt to go after this president and say, well, that can't be true, and that's not right, and the numbers weren't there. And there's a rush to judgment every time.
Well, in a much more measured tone and taking many questions, Spicer's comments came 2 days after he accused the media of deliberately misreporting the size of the crowd of President Trump's inauguration Friday. Also Monday, the U.S. Senate continued to fill Trump's national security team by confirming his pick for CIA director, Republican Congressman Mike Pompeo, and advancing his nominee for Secretary of State, oil executive Rex Tillerson. Meanwhile, President Trump had a conversation on Sunday with Israel's leader. Robert Berger has more on that from Jerusalem.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu congratulated President Donald Trump on the start of his term and thanked him for his deep friendship toward Israel. He also pointed to a key statement in Mr. Trump's inaugural address. Pointing to what he sees as a mutual enemy, Netanyahu said that he very much appreciates the new president's willingness to fight radical Islamic terrorism with full force. Radical Islamic terrorism is a phrase former President Barack Obama refused to use, one of the many differences of opinion he had with the Israeli leader. Netanyahu, who spoke at the weekly cabinet meeting in Jerusalem, said there are many important things to discuss now with President Trump. Robert Berger, Jerusalem.
Also on Monday, President Trump faced his first legal challenge to the administration. A watchdog group called Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, filed the lawsuit Monday in New York, charging that the new president's vast business holdings place him in violation of an obscure clause in the U.S. Constitution. Trump quickly dismissed the move, saying the lawsuit's totally without merit. Joining me now to talk more about it is one of those people named in the lawsuit, Richard Painter, former ethics attorney for President George W. Bush.
We filed in federal court in New York a complaint against the president in his official capacity, asking the court to issue an injunction prohibiting the president from taking payments from foreign governments that violate the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution.
What exactly is that?
The Emoluments Clause prohibits any presence, any salary or benefit or profit from business dealings with foreign governments. And it's there because the founders were very concerned that American government officials would be engaged in business transactions, receiving gifts or stipends or titles of nobility from foreign governments. That would compromise their loyalties to the United States.
How is it that we know so soon that the president is violating that?
We know that the president's hotels do business with foreign governments, including foreign diplomats staying in the hotels and foreign governments leasing out ballrooms for functions. And we know that that accelerated that type of business as soon as he was elected president. I believe that the Bank of China is controlled by the government of China, has loaned Trump businesses substantial amounts of money, and that other Chinese government-owned banks are leasing space in Trump office buildings. That's what we know of. What we do not know, enterprises all over the world, the debt is mostly at the corporate level. He has not reassured us even that categorically there is no Russian government money in any of his business enterprises. I have yet to hear that from the White House. I would like to hear that at least. But there are many countries all over the world that could very well have loaned money to President Trump and it hasn't been paid off. We simply don't know. And we're hoping that he will provide answers in response to this lawsuit.
When he was asked about it by reporters on Monday, he said that it has no merit. Is it possible that a federal judge will just will stand by that?
I'm not going to guess what the judge is going to say, but if we did not think this case had merit, and I mean a lot of merit, we would not have brought the case in front of the court.
If the judge decides that this doesn't have merit, will there still be issues that arise as far as conflict of interest, or will that be the end of it?
Well, we'd wait for the judge's decision to decide and figure out what the judge has decided and why before we would decide to take the next step. But the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution is very clear that nobody holding a position of trust with the United States government can receive payments, benefits from foreign governments. It's quite extensive, the coverage of the Emoluments Clause. I was told when I was in the Bush White House that it prohibited.
My understanding is that somebody else might, in a different sort of situation, like a business competitor that would potentially demonstrate that they've lost clients or profits to Trump firms now that it has the Trump presidency benefiting that company, that they would have a better chance of raising that issue legally.
Well, they might very well want to raise that issue with respect to unfair competition under the unfair competition laws in the particular jurisdiction. I'm not involved in those types of lawsuits. I'm not going to be involved in private suits against the president. Our action is action against the president in his official capacity, seeking an injunction prohibiting him from accepting any emoluments, any payments, benefits from any foreign governments while he is president of the United States, because that is unconstitutional.
Well, at a news conference earlier this month, one of Donald Trump's attorneys insisted that he is meeting all of his ethical obligations. Trump announced at that news conference that he was handing over full control of his businesses to his two sons, along with one of his Trump Organization executives. Eric Trump characterized this lawsuit as very, very sad, telling the New York Times it is purely harassment for political gain. Many analysts, though, however, say that anything short of a blind trust leads Trump open to repeated questions about whether his actions as president are intended to benefit his financial interests. Turning now to what's trending on social media, we're joined by G. Abby Lee. Hey, G, what's been going on?
Hi, Lori. Let's start in Mosul, Iraq. After 2.5 years under the ISIS control, schools in a northern Iraqi city are reopening. You can find photos from the eventful day by using hashtags like Mosul or ISIS.
Wow, that's great. That's great. So what's happening on the stateside?
There's a lot of talk about the new administration's withdrawal from TPP or the Trans-Pacific Partnership. People are debating the impact it will have on the U.S. economy and also foreign policy because it used to be a bargaining chip against Beijing for some time. There's also lively discussion on the president's executive order reinstating Reagan's Mexico City policy. The rule prohibits the U.S. from providing funding to international health organizations that provide abortions.
Right. It's also commonly known as the global gag rule. Mm-hmm. Anything trending on the entertainment front?
90s kids are either rejoicing or protesting a planned Britney Spears biopic by cable TV network Lifetime. The program is titled Britney Ever After and contains the infamous head-shaving incident. We all know what we're talking about. That's referring to the 2007 incident when she shaved her head herself, and it was well-documented all over the internet.
Right, so why the controversy?
Some people find it a bit cruel that the unauthorized biopic includes parts of her life that she doesn't want to discuss very much, like her struggles with child custody and alleged drug abuse. Last but not least, Lori, if you want to learn more about the spring makeup trend, just search for holographic cosmetics. It's all about that unicorn look. People are sharing photos of their makeup products with names like Unicorn Tears and The Alchemist. They're super glittery and have duochrome finishes. Back to you.
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. No breakthrough in day one of Syria peace talks in Kazakhstan. Former U.S. President George H.W. Bush recovering from pneumonia. A steady stream of immigration announcements expected from Donald Trump. The Atlanta Falcons will face the New England Patriots in the Super Bowl. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, following the inauguration of a new president and the women's marches that followed over the weekend, there is clearly a divide. But Donald Trump tapped into a segment of the American population that has felt forgotten and disenfranchised. He promised they would now have a voice. Joining me now to understand more about this, Justin Guest, author of The New Minority, White Working Class Politics in an Age of Immigration and Inequality. He's also an assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. Well, thank you for being here. It's a pretty remarkable rise to power for Donald Trump.
The most important trend to come out of this election is that Donald Trump has been able to consolidate a white working class constituency, a voting bloc, that really hasn't existed for several generations. And in doing so, he's crystallized a sense of group consciousness amongst that constituency. And group consciousness is a concept that social scientists previously used to characterize African-American people, Latinos, Asian-Americans, small minorities in the United States. Once they feel like there's a sense of we, a sense of who we are. And for a very long period of time, white working class people just simply didn't have that sense of we. So Donald Trump's biggest achievement has been to create a sense of we-ness within the white working class.
But in doing so, there are a lot of other people out there, as we have seen over the weekend, with the monstrous protests from so many different segments of the population, not only here in the United States, but apparently across the globe, people that are concerned about so many different things, minorities, immigrants, women, people in the science community, people around the world that are worried about how their countries will be protected as they have been in the past by the United States. And do they need to also go it alone or themselves first? Is that, in essence, also creating sort of another new minority?
I don't think so. I think that to be considered a minority, to think of yourself as a constituency, there has to be something that holds you together. And I think that what was so remarkable about the day of protest that we saw the Saturday following was that it was a remarkably diverse group of constituencies that came together, unified in their disdain for Donald Trump. You know, along his remarkable journey to the White House, Donald Trump alienated a number of large groups of people, in many cases holistically, because he holistically condemned them. In his comments about Mexicans and other Latino immigrants, in his comments about the African-American community and Black Lives Matter and the nature of American urban inner cities, in his comments about banning Muslims and the disabled, he alienated groups holistically, and so those groups holistically came out against him. But rest assured, this was a very close election. And had Hillary Clinton emerged victorious, you would have seen a lot of angry Donald Trump constituents continue to simmer in the American public. And you could have seen a day of protest there. It's just that protest is really the method of expression of the left more than it is of the right.
You've got one segment of the population now, the white working class, that for a long time have felt unheard, and the president says he hears them. What happens to all the other people now who feel disenfranchised?
I think that this subject demonstrates the subjectivity, the nuance of political rhetoric. You know, when Donald Trump was praising America and talking about America and his references to America in his inaugural address, I think it's extraordinary how clearly so many of those groups who I said earlier that he had alienated did not feel a part of that America. And in many ways, the patriotism that he was talking about in his speech is much more akin to the patriotism that has been existent in Europe for a very long period of time. In many parts of Europe, it's actually frowned upon to wave a German flag or an English flag in England, because it's associated with fascism. Nationalism there is viewed as an ugly thing. And in many ways, that is the kind of nationalism that Donald Trump is slowly crafting here in the United States. This is new for the United States, but it's actually been around, this kind of patriotism, this kind of exclusive patriotism in Europe for a number of decades.
Well, we appreciate your perspective. Justin Guest, author of The New Minority, White Working Class Politics in an Age of Immigration and Inequality. Thanks for being with us. Severe weekend weather has killed at least 20 people in the southern United States and injured many more. Emergency management officials warned New York City residents to brace for heavy rains and winds up to 110 kilometers per hour. Coastal regions from Virginia to Boston were hit by rain, snow, and wind. The vast storm system tore through the southeast over 2 days, spawning tornadoes, huge rain and wind storms, and pulverizing mobile homes and leaving destruction in its wake.
After we start hearing the sirens going off, I looked outside and noticed it started getting dark and the wind was pretty harsh. So by then I went and told the kids, hey, let's go get in the closet. And by the time we got in there, we got settled. That's when it hit.
January tornado outbreaks are rare but not unprecedented, particularly in the South. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth look at the historic U.S. presidential election and how the results could change the political landscape in the United States. That's right here on the next Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. An official of China's National Health and Family Planning Commission said Sunday that China last year saw the highest number of births this century. The news comes more than a year after the government relaxed its 40-year one-child policy, including fines and forced abortions to curb a rising population. In 2016, he said China welcomed nearly 18 million new children, an increase of nearly 8% over 2015. Even though the number of women of childbearing age fell by 5 million. University of Chicago China political scientist Dahlia Young tells VOA's Victor Beatty, that he believes the spike in births will be short-lived.
The problem is, of course, this bump is more likely going to be temporary because the number of childbearing age women is actually declining very significantly at the same time. Over time, therefore, especially as the desire for having children actually is not increasing in the Chinese society. So this is, again, a temporary phenomenon, and the challenges of maintaining a robust birth rate in China remain.
Dali Yang, was the one-child policy a disaster for China?
I think, again, it's a policy fraught with a lot of controversy because it had variety of bad effects, but at the same time, of course, the proponents of the policy justified it on the basis of the need to develop the economy, and particularly after a decade of super population growth in the 1970s in particular. However, economists in particular, some of my colleagues, including the former economist Ezekiel Johnson, argue that even without such a policy, China's population growth would have moderated anyway, because societies in the rest of East Asia, including Hong Kong, Taiwan, have all actually seen their fertility rates decline dramatically. So a lot of the decline in population growth could have been sort of promoted by better urbanization, a lot of other policies, rather than simply forcing such draconian measures in the short run.
Well, Japan also has a very aging population. So is Asia reaching its peak as far as population is concerned?
In the bulk of East Asia, including Japan, South Korea, and of course the across the strait in Taiwan, population growth rates have been so low, it's become a major, major challenge. But of course in South Asia in particular, India, Bangladesh, and Pakistan, population growth continues to be very high. In fact, fairly soon we are talking about India having more population than China. So in that sense, I think actually overall, the East Asian population has largely plateaued.
Reggie Littlejohn, founder and president of Women's Rights Without Frontiers, has said that to encourage more births, the government must also find a way to reduce the cost of housing and education. And she said that under the two-child policy, selective abortions of girls continues if the first child is a girl.
This is Science in a Minute.
Systems that prevent computers from being accessed by unauthorized users are becoming quite sophisticated. Among the tools being used to protect computers and valuable data include complex passwords, voice recognition, smart cards, as well as fingerprint, iris, and retina scans. Now, a group of researchers at the State University of New York at Binghamton have come up with a unique new way to protect electronic health records. The patient's own heartbeat. The patient's own electrocardiograph, or ECG, which measures the electrical activity of the heart with a biosensor attached to the skin, is what is used to actually encrypt the confidential data. Since a person's ECG may change at times due to factors such as age, illness, or injury, the researchers say that they are working on ways to take these changes into consideration. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, some scientists say 3D printing is marking the beginning of a new industrial revolution. And the future, they say, holds the tantalizing dream of machines that can create their own replacement parts and home printers that can build nearly anything you or your kids can imagine. But the one room in the house where 3D printing hasn't really had much of a future is the kitchen. Until now, VOA's Kevin Enox reports.
This three-dimensional printer at Columbia University is busy making cookies. Well, one very cool three-dimensional cookie. Researchers here are trying to bring the world of 3D printing to the kitchen.
Our kitchen right now is the last frontier of technology. If you think about it, software has entered every other field, but in the kitchen, we still cook like cavemen. We cook over an open flame. We use very primitive tools. But what will happen when this technology will enter the kitchen? I think it's going to be a revolution.
Lipson says cooking with software seems fairly natural to millennials who have incorporated technology into other aspects of their lives. So his students teamed up with a group of chefs from the International Culinary Center in New York for a two-day 3D food printing marathon. The goal was to come up with some printable and tasty high-end cuisine.
So we developed different flavor with vegetable, with polenta, with chicken, with fish, and we was able to print.
But is it restaurant worthy? These chefs were skeptical, mainly, they say, because all the ingredients needed to be ground up into a paste.
It is something I will see in a restaurant, in a professional world? I don't think so. I don't think so that's their goal. They're looking more for home.
And this is the home version, a prototype of a 3D printer coming soon to your kitchen. Snap in a cartridge of ingredients and out comes a nutritious, good-looking, and good-for-you meal. Developers say the technology is just waiting for people to start using it.
We'll be able to, some recipes might go viral and we'll be able to taste them on the spot. And particularly, we might be able to connect food with personalized health, biometrics, personalized medicine, our genome in ways that we can't do today.
But how does it taste? Evidently, the jury's still out. Kevin Enix, VOA News, Washington.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Well, you've been listening to International Edition. This does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From time to time, the United States identifies certain individuals as crucial to the operation of terrorist organizations. Most often, these are top leaders, or they help finance terrorist organizations. In all cases, these are people who have committed or are deemed to pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism. When such people are identified, the U.S. government places their name on the specially designated nationals list. Their assets within U.S. jurisdiction are immediately frozen, and they are locked out of the global financial network. No U.S. citizen or company may conduct business with a designated individual. In this way, the United States disrupts financial support networks for terrorists and terrorist organizations. In early January, the United States Department of State named as a specially designated global terrorist Hamza bin Laden, a son of global terrorist and founder of the Al-Qaeda terror network Osama bin Laden. Hamza bin Laden, born around 1989, was officially named an Al-Qaeda member in a 2015 audio message by Ayman al-Zawahiri, who has headed the terror group since the 2011 death of Osama bin Laden. As part of the same audio message, Hamza bin Laden threatened attacks against the United States as well as Americans abroad. He also called for lone offender attacks against U.S., French, and Israeli interests in Washington, Paris, and Tel Aviv. Similarly, in a message issued in the summer of 2016, Hamza bin Laden called on tribes based in Saudi Arabia to unite with al-Qaeda's affiliate in Yemen and together to wage war against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The State Department's designation serves notice globally that Hamza bin Laden is actively engaged in terrorism. Designations of terrorist individuals and groups expose and isolate them and serve as a useful tool to assist or complement the law enforcement actions of other U.S. agencies as well as other governments.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
is 4.